Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. On the show today, another segment of a podcast from the American Academy of Achievement. Also later, Brian Lynn tells of new findings in an old mystery. And as always, we close the show with an American story. But first, a report from Ashley Thompson.
With U.S.-Cambodian relations suffering, the United States is trying a new way to spread positive opinions of America through music. Yorn Young is a well-known Cambodian musician. Last week, he launched a new album called Lovin' USA, Yorn Young Journey Across America. Yorn Young told the Reuters news agency that he is set to make more than $10,000 from the United States for a concert later this month in Cambodia's Kampong Thom province. More concerts could follow. He said he is not worried if people think his song is propaganda. Young said, "When there is tension, countries seek ways to ease it so arts and culture can help." Yorn Young has performed at concerts sponsored by the Cambodian government as well. He says he has a good relationship with government officials. The U.S. Embassy in Phnom Penh believes Yorn Young's music could help improve the U.S.-Cambodia relationship. Monica Davis, a cultural affairs officer at the embassy, said, "I think it brings us closer together." Relations between the United States and Cambodia have worsened during a crackdown on opponents of Prime Minister Hun Sen. He has led the country for 33 years. Under his rule, Cambodia has become one of China's closest regional allies. The United States reduced aid to the country after opposition leader Kem Sokha was arrested last year. Cambodia's government has accused the United States of supporting opposition plots to win power. Hun Sen often reminds Cambodians about American bombings of the country that began in the late 1960s and the U.S.-backed coup in 1970. Shortly after, U.S. troops from Vietnam invaded Cambodia. The war spread, leading to the takeover by the genocidal Khmer Rouge in 1975. The songs on Yorn Young's Lovin' USA album are about the beauty of U.S. cities and states that he recently visited. His visits were paid for by the U.S. government. One of his new songs is called Florida, Florida. In a slow and emotional style, he sings lines like, "Cannot believe it's real. Smiling scenery so appealing." Yorn Young says the United States has remained important to Cambodians. In Cambodia, people spend U.S. dollars. The internet is American. Everything is American, he said. Sok Isan is a spokesman for the ruling Cambodian People's Party. He said he welcomed the musical efforts as a positive sign. But he also criticized what he called the Trump administration's support of its puppet, the opposition party. The United States has dismissed accusations of American support for a plot by Kem Sokha, who faces treason charges. Kem Sokha says the charges are meant to stop him from taking part in the July election. The Trump administration said recently it was suspending or reducing several assistance programs that support Cambodia's military, taxation department, and local officials. In answer, Hun Sen challenged the United States to end all aid to Cambodia and noted his country's growing help from China. Cambodia is expected to receive more than $260 million in aid from China in 2018. That is more than seven times as much from the United States. Most Chinese aid goes to big projects, such as building dams, roads, and power structures, rather than soft power efforts.
A new study suggests bones found on a Pacific island in 1940 were likely those of famous American pilot Amelia Earhart. If true, the findings would end a long debate over what happened to Earhart. She disappeared in 1937 over the southern Pacific Ocean. At the time, Earhart was attempting to become the first woman to fly around the world. She was 39 years old. Her navigator, Fred Noonan, was also on the plane that disappeared. In 1940, a group of bones was discovered on the Pacific island of Niku Maroro. Some believed the bones belonged to Earhart, but a scientist who took measurements at the time concluded that they belonged to a man who did not match the description of Noonan. The bones were later lost. All that survived were seven measurements. They showed the size of the skull and of bones from the arm and leg. In 2015, researchers completed a new analysis based on the measurements. Those researchers said their findings confirmed the earlier conclusion. The bones did not belong to Earhart or Noonan. But the new study, appearing in the publication Forensic Anthropology, challenges those findings. Richard Jantz led the study. He is an anthropologist from the University of Tennessee. Jantz said his study provides evidence that strongly supports the bones belonged to Earhart. The bones are consistent with Earhart in all respects we know or can reasonably infer, he wrote in the study. During his research, Jantz compared the bone measurements to photographs and examinations of Earhart's clothing. He says that until new evidence is presented that the bones are not those of Amelia Earhart, the most convincing argument is that they are hers. Ever since Earhart's plane disappeared in 1937, people have sought to learn what happened to the plane and its crew. The plane had left from what is now Papua New Guinea. The next goal of the flight was to reach Howland Island, about 4,000 kilometers to the east. But Earhart and Noonan never arrived there. Flight experts decided the plane must have crashed in the sea after using up all its fuel. Searchers found no other explanation. But observers have long shared rumors about what really happened. One unconfirmed report said Earhart had made her final flight while working as an American spy. The story claimed then-President Franklin D. Roosevelt had asked her to observe Japanese activity in the Pacific. At the time, U.S. relations with Japan were tense. In 1941, Japan bombed the American military base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. The attack led to America's involvement in World War II. Another report suggested Japanese forces or civilians had rescued Earhart and taken her to Japan. This rumor, or similar ones, said she died there. Still another rumor claimed she was freed after the war ended. It claimed that she lived under another name in the United States. I'm Brian Lynn.
Next up, What It Takes. Here is host Alice Winkler.
Every episode, we pull an interview out of the Academy's vault. These are interviews with amazing people, people whose lives and work have stood the test of time and continue to inspire. But on this episode, we've got an interview that was done so recently, it hasn't made it into the vault. So why are we rushing to get this one on? Because it is about a doctor whose research is helping revolutionize the way cancers are going to be treated in the future. For certain cancers, in fact, the revolution is already well underway. It's called immunotherapy. So who doesn't want to hear a story ASAP about someone successfully kicking cancer's butt? Meet Dr. Steve Rosenberg, Chief of Surgery at the National Cancer Institute. His story, told to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Mary Jordan, is riveting.
When I was a resident in surgery, I was rotating through the West Roxbury VA hospital. This was as a junior resident.
It was the mid-1960s.
And I was working in the emergency ward, taking care of people who were coming in, and this patient came in with right upper quadrant pain. It looked like a typical gallbladder attack. He was a 68-year-old man. And I pulled out his chart because we were going to take him to the operating room to take out his gallbladder, and this remarkable story unfolded. 12 years earlier, he had come to this same VA hospital. He had had a cancer in his stomach, a gastric cancer. He had been operated on. They opened the belly, and they saw the cancer. They saw it had spread to the liver. They biopsied the tumor in the liver. They could do nothing, and they closed the belly, saying that there was nothing more that could be done for this fellow. Well, they gave him an appointment to come back in 3 months. They never expected to see him, but sure enough, 3 months later, he showed up.
And his tumors seemed to be shrinking.
6 months later, he was gaining weight, and I'm turning the pages. And a year later, he was back at work. And here he was 12 years later, looking perfectly healthy with some right upper quadrant pain due to a gallbladder stone. So it was one of the first operations I did as a junior resident. We took out his gallbladder. We examined his belly thoroughly, and all of the cancer was gone.
Somehow, what did you think?
Somehow his body had figured out how to eliminate his cancer. It's one of the rarest events in all of medicine, a spontaneous regression of cancer in the absence of any treatment. I've only seen that one other time in my entire career of well over 5,000 cancer patients that I've treated.
And what did that lead you to do or to think?
Well, what that told me was that somehow the body in this particular patient had the tools to eliminate his own cancer. And it's the major body function that can protect us against outside influences like viruses, bacteria, and maybe even cancer is the immune system. And I thought that perhaps this patient's immune system had recognized his cancer as a foreign invader, the way it does the flu virus and so on, and had eliminated it. And that set me then on the trail of trying to see if I could reproduce that in other patients.
In other words, could he find a way to fire up the body's immune system so it would annihilate the invading cancer cells? Dr. Rosenberg didn't invent the notion, but it had been abandoned decades before in favor of chemotherapy and radiation. Dr. Rosenberg could not shake what he'd seen in that one patient, and he hasn't shaken it since, not through the rest of his residency and not in the 42 years he has served as chief of surgery at the National Cancer Institute, a branch of the National Institutes of Health, NIH, located in Bethesda, Maryland. Rosenberg was appointed chief of surgery in 1974 and began his post the day after finishing his residency. He's now 76, and it is the only job he has ever had. Over those 40-plus years, developments in other areas of medicine have been key to helping Dr. Rosenberg and other scientists make leaps forward in immunotherapy. He started doing this work, for example, well before the human genome was mapped, and well before there was a way to manipulate immune cells, or lymphocytes, outside of the body.
And so one of the first things we tried, which in retrospect, very naive scientifically, is we tried to immunize experimental animals with a patient's cancer and use their lymphocytes, because the lymphocytes are the immune warriors in the body, use that animal's lymphocytes to treat the patient. And so we looked for which animal would be most likely to produce cells that would react against the patient's cancer. And quite unfortunately, it turned out to be the mini pigs had immune systems that seemed most relevant, which was a little bit of a problem for my father. I was brought up as an Orthodox Jew and was quite religious when I was growing up. I've wandered. And when I would describe this to my father and tell him that we were going to take pig lymphocytes and put them into a patient, he was horrified. But if it could help people, then of course that's acceptable in any, certainly in the Jewish religion. But it didn't work.
You can find the whole podcast on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Now it's time for an American story. Today we hear the final part of The Diamond Lens by Fitzjames O'Brien.
When I was a child, someone gave me a microscope. I spent hours looking through that microscope, exploring nature's tiny secrets. As I grew up, I became more interested in my microscope than in people. When I was 20 years old, my parents sent me to New York City to study medicine. I never went to any of my classes. Instead, I spent all my time, and a lot of my money, trying to build the perfect microscope. I wanted to make a powerful lens that would let me see even the smallest parts of life. But all my experiments failed. Then, one day, I met a young man who lived in the apartment above mine. Jules Simon told me about a woman who could speak to the dead. When I visited Madame Volpe's, she let me speak to the spirit of the man who invented the microscope. The spirit of Anton Leeuwenhoek told me how to make a perfect lens from a diamond of 140 carats. But where could I find a diamond that big? When I returned home, I went to Simon's apartment. He was surprised to see me and tried to hide a small object in his pocket. I wanted to discover what it was, so I brought two bottles of wine to his apartment. We began to drink. By the time we had finished the first bottle, Simon was very drunk. "Simon, I know you have a secret. Why don't you tell me about it?" Something in my voice must have made him feel safe. He made me promise to keep his secret. Then he took a small box from his pocket. When he opened it, I saw a large diamond, shaped like a rose. A pure white light seemed to come from deep inside the diamond. Simon told me he had stolen the diamond from a man in South America. He said it weighed exactly 140 carats. Excitement shook my body. I could not believe my luck. On the same evening that the spirit of Leeuwenhoek tells me the secret of the perfect lens, I find the diamond I need to create it. I decided to steal Simon's treasure. I sat across the table from him as he drank another glass of wine. I knew I could not simply steal the diamond. Simon would call the police. There was only one way to get the diamond. I had to kill Simon. Everything I needed to murder Simon was right there in his apartment. A bottle full of sleeping powder was on a table near his bed. A long, thin knife lay on the table. Simon was so busy looking at his diamond that I was able to put the drug in his glass quite easily. He fell asleep in 15 minutes. I put his diamond in my pocket and carried Simon to the bed. I wanted to make the police think Simon had killed himself. I picked up Simon's long, thin knife and stared down at him. I tried to imagine exactly how the knife would enter Simon's heart if he were holding the knife himself. I pushed the knife deep into his heart. I heard a sound come from his throat, like the bursting of a large bubble. His body moved, and his right hand grabbed the handle of the knife. He must have died immediately. I washed our glasses and took the two wine bottles away with me. I left the lights on, closed the door, and went back to my apartment. Simon's death was not discovered until 3 o'clock the next day. One of the neighbors knocked at his door, and when there was no answer, she called the police. They discovered Simon's body on the bed. The police questioned everyone, but they did not learn the truth. The police finally decided Jules Simon had killed himself. And soon everyone forgot about him. I had committed the perfect crime. For 3 months after Simon's death, I worked day and night on my diamond lens. At last, the lens was done. My hands shook as I put a drop of water on a piece of glass. Carefully, I added some oil to the water to prevent it from drying. I turned on a strong light under the glass and looked through the diamond lens. For a moment, I saw nothing in that drop of water, and then I saw a pure white light. Carefully, I moved the lens of my microscope closer to the drop of water. Slowly, the white light began to change. It began to form shapes. I could see clouds and wonderful trees and flowers. These plants were the most unusual colors, bright reds, greens, purples, as well as silver and gold. The branches of these trees moved slowly in a soft wind. Everywhere I looked, I could see fruits and flowers of 1,000 different colors. How strange, I thought, that this beautiful place has no animal life in it. Then I saw something moving slowly among the brightly colored trees and bushes. The branches of a purple and silver bush were gently pushed aside, and there, before my eye, stood the most beautiful woman I had ever seen. She was perfect. Pink skin, large blue eyes, and long golden hair that fell over her shoulders to her knees. She stepped away from the rainbow-colored trees, like a flower, floating on water, she drifted through the air. Watching her move was like listening to the sound of tiny bells ringing in the wind. She went to the rainbow-colored trees and looked up at one of them. The tree moved one of its branches that was full of fruit. It lowered the branch to her, and she took one of the fruits. She turned it in her tiny hands and began to eat. How I wished I had the power to enter that bright light and float with her through those beautiful forests. Suddenly, I realized I had fallen in love with this tiny creature. I loved someone who would never love me back, someone who was a prisoner in a drop of water. I ran out of the room, threw myself on my bed, and cried till I fell asleep. Day after day, I returned to my microscope to watch her. I never left my apartment. I rarely even ate or slept. One day, as usual, I went to my microscope, ready to watch my love. She was there, but a terrible change had taken place. Her face had become thin, and she could hardly walk. The wonderful light in her golden hair and blue eyes was gone. At that moment, I would have given my soul to become as small as she and enter her world to help her. What was causing her to be so sick? She seemed in great pain. I watched her for hours, helpless and alone with my breaking heart. She grew weaker and weaker. The forest also was changing. The trees were losing their wonderful colors. Suddenly, I realized I had not looked at the drop of water for several days. I had looked into it with the microscope, but not at it. As soon as I looked at the glass under the microscope, I understood the horrible truth. I had forgotten to add more oil to the drop of water to stop it from drying. The drop of water had disappeared. I rushed again to look through the lens. The rainbow forests were all gone. My love lay in a spot of weak light. Her pink body was dried and wrinkled. Her eyes were black as dust. Slowly, she disappeared forever. I fainted and woke many hours later on pieces of my microscope. I had fallen on it when I fainted. My mind was as broken as the diamond lens. I crawled to my bed and withdrew from the world. When I finally got better, months later, all my money was gone. People now say I am crazy. They call me Linley, the mad scientist. No one believes I spoke to the spirit of Leeuwenhoek. They laugh when I tell them how I killed Jules Simon and stole his diamond to make the perfect lens. They think I never saw that beautiful world in a drop of water. But I know the truth of the diamond lens, and now so do you.
We have come to the end of today's show. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.